Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Well, the National Party has a new front bench that features some freshly promoted new faces, and former leader Judith Collins has been sent to the back of the pack. It is one of six portfolio reshuffles off the back of a series of leadership challenges, changes and retirements in the last 2 years. Newly minted leader Christopher Luxon is confident this shadow cabinet will be the one that propels National back into power come election 2023. Here's our political reporter Annika Smith.
Hot off the back of the latest leadership chapter, Chris Luxon has handed out his team jerseys. Number 2 to his deputy, Nicola Willis. Number 3 to finance spokesperson, Simon Bridges. And number 4 to National's COVID-19 delegate, Chris Bishop. Dr. Shane Reti is next on the list, keeping a hold of one of the largest and arguably most important portfolios, health. His focus is delayed procedures and the looming health restructure. More pressing, however, is the country's ICU capacity and how it will fare over summer.
We're going to put the whole system under stress and let's see how it copes. And for goodness sake, we need to be prepared for what may be a fragile system. So we don't need to wait a year to know how we're doing. We're going to get a litmus test really soon as people start embarking on their summer journeys.
Shane Reti says he's excited about the shape of National's new team, having previously served as Judith Collins' deputy. She, however, has taken a skydive, plummeting to number 19, and given the Research, Science, Innovation and Technology portfolio. In stark contrast, East Coast Bay's MP Erica Stanford moves up 18 places. She remains National's immigration spokesperson, but now holds education too. Her first priority? Swatting up on her new portfolio.
There are probably a few teachers listening to this, and I'm not going to tell them on day one, you know, sort of what my plans are. The very first thing I need to do is get out and actually talk to the stakeholders, and I'll spend a lot of time listening.
National's chief whip, Matt Ducey, has also had a boost, moving up 12 spots to the front bench. He remains the party's mental health spokesperson and says if elected to power, National would establish a standalone mental health minister.
It's proven to be getting results in other jurisdictions across the world, and I think that the time's come. We need to get mental health out of health.
Simeon Brown has also jumped double digits, 10 spots, and now oversees transport and the public service. Scott Simpson now holds the climate change portfolio, sitting number 11 on the list. Southland MP Joseph Mooney has landed the space portfolio. And while you may think space is a suitable portfolio for someone whose last name is Mooney, it's no joke for the Southland MP.
It's become a really important and very fast-growing industry in New Zealand. Like, its value is equivalent to or possibly more than the viticulture industry already, and it's growing at pace.
There have been many firsts for National's many leaders in recent years. One more today for Chris Luxon, facing off against the Prime Minister in the House this afternoon. Both sides are ready.
Yeah, looking forward to it. I haven't had oral questions with the Prime Minister before. I'm sure it's going to be another new experience to add to the last week.
I wish the new Leader of the Opposition well. I don't imagine it's easy to manage a caucus where you have three past leaders within it, so that can't be an easy job. So I do wish him good luck.
Parliament's back sitting today after the drama that played out during the recess last week. 2 weeks to go, and then the House will adjourn for the Christmas break.
Some more on the National Party reshuffle. Deputy Leader Nicola Willis joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Corin.
If we start first with former leader Judith Collins, is she being punished for the way in which, I guess, her leadership came to an end?
Absolutely not. Judith has been given the Research, Science, Innovation and Technology portfolio. Those are areas she's shown a real interest in as leader, and that I know she's eager to get her teeth stuck into. She's a hard worker, and I imagine that we'll be seeing some real results from her.
Well, the next question is, should she be punished for the way in which she blew up the leadership?
Well, we've turned a page. Judith is no longer our leader. Christopher Luxon is now our leader, and I'm his deputy. We've had a new start and we're a reinvigorated team and we're ready to go.
What did Todd McClay do wrong? He's gone from sixth on the front bench to 33, is it?
Look, the reality is you can't fit all of your 33 MPs into your top 20. Todd McClay has been allocated portfolios which he has considerable experience and strength in, with trade and export growth and with tourism. He's very well suited to those portfolios, and I'm sure that he will make a big difference in them, getting around the country, listening to those tourism operators, and continuing to bring his expertise to bear on trade issues.
And is he happy to be falling that far?
Well, he's been commenting in the newspaper over the past 24 hours, and he's very eager to get stuck into those portfolios and get to work, and he's as energised as the rest of our team. By the fresh start we've had.
Okay, I mean, the fact, if you put it together, you've lost a bit of experience, I guess, might be one criticism, in that Todd McClay, Judith Collins, Michael Woodhouse have gone from your front bench, essentially. Are you a bit light on experience?
Well, those experienced members remain critical parts of our team. And when you look across our front bench, someone like Simon Bridges, who's been a former senior minister, he brings considerable experience to bear. Paul Goldsmith, Mark Mitchell, these are all people who have had ministerial roles. But we also see across our team real world experience, people who've come from a range of backgrounds and who will bring all of that to bear on their portfolios.
What like?
Well, I look at someone like Dr. Shane Retty, and I see someone who's actually worked inside our health system at the grassroots and understands it. And it gives me a lot of faith to know that he will be looking at how we can make our health system perform better for people, because he understands it from the grassroots up.
Real world experience, but some would argue a lack of diversity.
Well, that's something that Chris Luxon has been very upfront in acknowledging, which is that our caucus does lack the diversity that we would ideally have. We want to be a national party that represents groups from across the community, and we'll be focusing very hard on making sure we have that diversity of candidates going into the 2023 election.
So you've held on to the housing portfolio. A couple of questions on that. So there is some movement on this controversial intensification bill that both Labor and National had proposed that they would support in a show of bipartisanship. Been a change around some of the rules around boundaries and light and shading and things. It's gone from, what, 6 metres, and the government's moved it to 4 metres. Are you happy with that?
Yes, that's right. So what we've had is a very thorough select committee process in which we've had almost 1,000 submissions from people across the community about the draft bill. And that's resulted in a select committee report which makes dozens of recommendations. It's a 30-page report. We're going to look at 50 pages of amendments to make this bill as good as it can be. And one of the areas which has been improved is that whole area around the design standards for new housing. So we've recommended as a committee the introduction of landscaping requirements, for example, glazing requirements for the front of houses, and yes, a reduction in the height of buildings in relation to the boundary of their neighbours. And that's just about better balancing impact on...
Sure. Is this going to keep National on the page? Are you going to continue to support this bill? Because there has been a signal that, you know, you're wavering.
We have supported the series of recommendations coming out of the Select Committee, which we think will improve the bill, and we continue to want a bipartisan agreement on this. We know that New Zealand's housing challenges are critically important, and we think New Zealanders want to see us working with the government to make improvements where possible.
Right, just to be clear here, so you're saying you want to stay on board, you don't want to walk away, but what, are there going to be more negotiations around these amendments?
What you will see later this week is what's called an SOP introduced to Parliament, and that will contain the detailed amendments to this bill. We want to support this bill in an improved form from that which it was originally introduced, and that will all be available for public examination later this week.
Nicola Willis, thank you very much for your time. National Party Deputy Leader.
In INA, searchers for a man and his three children in a remote part of King Country in September initially believed they'd probably been washed out to sea. 34-year-old Thomas Phillips and his children, aged 5, 6 and 8, went missing from the small coastal community of Maraukopa after their vehicle was found on a nearby beach. A large air, land and sea search for them was suspended after 12 days. On September the 30th, the four walked into the family farmhouse. Our reporter Andrew McCrae's been looking over the documents, new documents about the search. Kia ora, Andrew. What do these documents that were released under the Official Information Act have to say?
Oh, hi, Susie. Well, there are two documents from Search and Rescue, called Scenario Weighting Worksheets. And this is where as a group, searchers analyse evidence to prove or disprove possible scenarios. Now, on day one of the search, which was September the 13th, there were six scenarios listed. And these include all four taken by the ocean, not wanting to be found, caught by the tide and went inland, not aware people were looking for them, and being hidden by family on their farm. Now, searchers then assign a value to each scenario, and then they're ranked. And on top was that the four were swept out to sea. Second most likely was not wanting to be found and are either in the area still or gone elsewhere. And the least likely was being hidden by family. On day two, the scenario rankings, they altered slightly, but being in the sea still came out on top, followed by a new one using the words despondent but non-suicidal. And I think we can presume that this referred to Thomas Phillips.
How did the research, how did the searchers actually use these scenarios?
In one police job sheet, they talk about that, and they note that although in the first 24 hours, Thomas Phillips was not responding to any search parties in the area, on day two, they say that may now have changed. They go on to say that with this in mind, consider any search that was conducted in areas where he may have been, which he may have been overlooked, to be searched again. Whereas now he's probably cold and wet and out of provisions that he may call out to searchers. Police also note that Thomas Phillips knows the beach area as well and is unlikely to get lost. And as we know, a lot of searching went on. It was hard slog by land searchers. There were steep cliffs, bush caves and really tough weather conditions on some of the days. A lot of use was made of drones. Both the police and fire and emergency used them during the search, with Fenn saying in one report, we're learning the effectiveness of drones.
So do we know how anything about how prepared the family was?
Not a lot, but they seemed that they were reasonably dressed for the occasion and for the basically the conditions they were experiencing. All bar one of the children were wearing jackets, as was their father. Two of the kids are noted in one report to be possibly barefooted. And in another report, a witness who saw the family on the beach earlier, they made the comment to police that some of the kids seemed to be overdressed.
Okay, so any word then, Andrew, on the cost of the search operation?
Well, that was certainly among the information we requested, but it was refused on the grounds of being prejudicial to current court and criminal proceedings. As we know, Thomas Phillips has been charged with causing wasteful deployment of police resources and personnel, and he's due in the Tikawiti District Court for a first appearance on January the 12th.
The Whānau Ora Commissioning Agency has had another win of sorts in the High Court over its battle to get information on unvaccinated North Island Māori from the Ministry of Health. Now, the Ministry had already provided some information to Whānau Ora following earlier court action, but the agency said it wasn't enough, and they went back to court. Last night, the High Court directed the Ministry to review its decision not to hand over any more details. Whānau Ora's Chief Executive, John Tamahiri, is with us now. Tēnā koe. So is this is another sort of win, isn't it? Because they could still, presumably, once they've had another review, not give you everything you want.
Well, you either reward people that can put needles in arms in terms of positive vaccinations in offers in communities where Mr. Bloomfield and his friends have failed, or you don't. And this isn't, I've said this to you before, this is not a competition. The High Court has again advised then within 3 days to release the data sets of unvaccinated Māori. That is a clear ruling. The second ruling they've made is that Māori requiring the second vaccination release the information, but you've got 3 days to review that decision. So the first decision is release unvaxxed Māori data. That is a no-brainer. Should have been done in September. We wouldn't be in any strife. The second one is it gives Bloomfield another discretion to deny us access to non-vaxxed second requirement jab people's right. We, in the court case, Bloomfield argued that we should wait 8 weeks before he gives that information over. Why 8 weeks when Parkers can get vaxxed in 3 weeks? Is iniquitous.
The judgment also says it makes it clear that some iwi did not consider it necessary for the data to be released to the your trust. So
yeah, that's true. And but some pakehas believe that vaccination shouldn't happen, and some pakehas believe that their information shouldn't be given to their bosses that they're not vaxxed, and some pakehas. So we get into this silly little circle of how many pakehas does it take to veto other pakehas. And so you're saying, oh, some Māoris might like it. These certain iwi warlords do not own a herd. I am from Ngāti Porou. My tuakana and cousin, that is our chairperson, I agree that he is my advocate on behalf of my whenua.
Well, hang on. So it talks about the whanganui iwi did not consider it necessary for data relating to their rohe to be shared with the applicants. They say they've already made it available to iwi and local providers. I mean, you're saying that should be overridden.
No, that's not true. What the Whanganui people said to us in a call with... here's the thing, Corin. The NHI is an ethnic descriptor. It doesn't have any iwi information in it whatsoever. So even if iwi want information, it is not available because it's just Māoris, right?
But just on the other side of the coin here, if you're in the Ministry of Health and you've got some iwi saying, no, look, we don't think the information needs to be handed over, we don't want it, and then they're being taken to court by you, you can understand how they're being squeezed in the middle a bit here.
No, I can't, because the first case was about Māori not being capable, or Māori not being able to be trusted with information, or Māori breaching privacy. All of these were struck down by the High Court in the first case. They then seized upon colonisation 101, divide and rule the natives. Now, I don't accept that, okay? What I do accept is, can Māori get an equality of opportunity to a vaccine access point? That's all this case is about. I think you're overcomplicating it, isn't it? You should boil it right down in a pandemic to how many people and who can get...
I think most people are pretty sympathetic with that idea of getting more Māori vaccinated. But is it, you say, I'm oversimplifying it, but you're saying it's a divide and rule strategy.
Well, haven't you worked that out yet?
But I mean, are you saying that the whanganui iwi would agree with your comment that it's that they're being divided and ruled?
Yeah, but whanganui iwi don't control my Ngāti Porou people that live in the whanganui town centre. Whanganui people don't control and own a herd. Iwi leaders don't control and own a herd. We're not animals. We're people with rights to access vaccination issues. The Whanganui people got it wrong too. What they had access to was heat maps. They did not have access to information, and furthermore, they didn't have the capacity to deliver. So we've got to get a grown-up conversation about how you deploy in the most efficient way possible vaccine opportunities.
Mm. I mean, I guess this is the second decision by the court urging the ministry to go away and review it. What happens next here if they don't give you what you want?
Well, look, we've proven beyond all reasonable doubt that these decision makers are wrong. We now need to look to a government somewhere seizing back control for the elected political leadership. You see, COVID, there's been a COVID coup, and everywhere you go, there's faceless, unelected bureaucrats making all sorts of unusual decisions. We'll come, I'm sure you and I will have conversations about this in 2022, 2023, when the true light of day starts to flash on these things.
John Tamahiri, appreciate your time. Kia ora, whānau ora, Chief Executive.
Let's get more now on the new national strategy out this morning to eliminate family and sexual violence in the next 25 years. Governments have tried and failed for many years to get on top of the problem, but a new partnership between community groups and the government aims to set the country on the right path. Earlier, I spoke to the Minister for the Prevention of Family and Sexual Violence, Marama Davidson, and asked her what the first steps are in the plan.
We hope to increase reporting of family violence and sexual violence. Right now, the majority of our cases are underreported. At least 80% of harm does not go anywhere, people do not put their hands up. What we need to be able to see in the next couple of years is people feeling safe to be able to put their hands up, because there will be a stronger workforce with the right skills at the right time, so that when people put up their hand, They will not be further harmed by government agencies, but they will receive actual support and long-term focus on healing with a strong prevention focus to stop violence from happening in the first place.
So a success might be that it looks much worse initially. What does that support look like for families? If they put up their hand, they say that this is a problem for them, what can they get? What will they be able to manage to achieve?
Well, firstly, that people, when they put up their hand, will be believed and respected in the very first instance. This is the system change that we want. You'll see in the strategy that it makes it very clear that the system needs to be accountable, that we can no longer disbelieve people, that we need to provide whatever the wraparound support is, that is unique to their needs as well. So again, Susie, Māori women, disabled people, rainbow people, older people, ethnic people have not been catered for. There have not been good enough or enough services for particular communities of people. And in the very first instance, I really want to be able to see in the next 2 years people being able to get the help they want, to be believed and respected at every step of their journey.
This will involve working with several departments, I'm sure, police and Oranga Tamariki spring to mind. There may not be very high trust within some of these communities towards some of those agencies. So how is that going to work? Why would people necessarily put their hand up if then they end up having to work with people that they maybe don't feel that comfortable with?
And that is true at the moment across the entire system, Susie. There is not the level of trust and safety that people feel there is to be able to ask for help. It's not limited to any one or two agencies. What we have seen is good examples of where we bring the agencies together, including police, for example, the what are called the safety tables around the country, where police do literally sit down at the table with community, with iwi, with tangata whenua, with the sector specialists and organisations like Women's Refuge, where everyone sits down together, authentically works together, it is showing to increase people's trust. It is showing to have better outcomes for people who need help when they need help.
What resourcing is this plan going to get? Because it sounds like it will need a fair heft.
So you'll see that the strategy comes with an action plan. The action plan gives us a really awesome opportunity to lay down the foundations for the whole strategy over the next couple of years. That strategy has been worked on across the agencies. It has 40 actions in it. The majority of those actions have already begun or are able to be funded already in the baselines of what we've currently got. Of course, there are some actions that will require some new funding, and that is a process that all ministers and agencies have agreed. Those actions are a priority, so I'm really confident that we are starting out with an action plan that can be delivered.
Talk me through an example of how this would work. A family has got issues with violence within it. Say the woman has put her hand up and has reported this. Take me through the steps of what would then happen downstream.
Sure. In the first instance, that woman, any person, needs to feel that they can put their hand up because she, that person, will be believed, will be respected for who they are, that the person dealing with them will have the tools to recognise and deliver a trauma-informed approach, that they will understand that people in different states of putting their hand up may not be able to give a completely coherent outline or story of what has happened to them, and that that person will get the support, whether that's the counselling support, the advocacy support, the navigation support, to be able to work through what is at the moment a very complicated system. So they will be believed, they will be given and listened to about what their needs are, and the needs could vary. They could be in a pretty crappy housing situation at the moment. They could be dealing with other influences, with other sort of situations in their lives that require extra support. And of course we lead to the support, the ongoing support, not just for the incident but for the healing. And that is crucial here, Susie. We have not had enough focus on the long-term needs for healing either.
That is the Minister for the Prevention of Family and Sexual Violence, Marama Davidson. Now, a new survey of teachers show the pandemic is taking an increasingly heavy toll on them and their pupils. Many teachers have reported their pupils' behaviour has deteriorated, and teachers themselves are more tired and unhappier than they were last year. About 1,200 people and more than 400 teachers responded to the Education Review Office survey. The Aero's Ruth Shinoda is with us now. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
This makes for quite worrying reading, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, we are really concerned. It shows that well-being for teachers is really decreasing, with only half of teachers reporting being happy at work. And they're finding workload increasingly unmanageable, with only one-fifth of principals finding it manageable now.
Why?
What we're saying is that they've had to do a whole heap for their students and also for their communities. There's a lot of the teachers and principals we've talked about have gone above and beyond in terms of helping their students and communities and also doing online teaching and adjusting, as well as then encountering, as you said, some behaviour issues among students needing additional support with their learning. That all combines to quite a lot of pressure on teachers and principals.
What are some of the behaviours that you're being given as examples?
So about a third of schools said that they, in June and July, that they were seeing behaviour worse than they would expect for that time of the year. The kind of examples they gave was for older students, trouble concentrating, getting back into study habits, getting ready for exams and knowing how to really focus. And then for younger students, some of those new entrants just aren't quite school ready because they've had quite a long time at home. And so they struggle with things like sitting on the mat, getting on with their peers, concentrating again. So there's a bit of a mixture. We're not that surprised because earlier this year we produced a report about impact on students, and that did show a high level of anxiety among students.
I'm interested that high decile schools are observing behaviour was worse compared to low decile schools. Why would that be?
Honest answer is we're not sure, and that's an area that we really want to follow up on. What we did hear in some low decile communities is that students got to spend more time with their parents, and that was a really good thing. But behind this one, we're just not sure.
And so what does this tell us for the future in terms of, I suppose, first of all, for the students here, if they're needing to be spoon-fed the information more than perhaps they have been in the past, what does that indicate for their future learning?
So what we're saying is that the finding is for students is that quite a few students are going to need help re-engaging. We saw attendance falls off after lockdown and it takes a long while to get back up again. So getting back into school, getting back into those patterns and then catching up their learning. And then what this report really focuses on is the support that teachers and principals are going to need, because next year is going to be another challenging year.
Yeah, of course, this is not over yet, and indeed we don't know how long all of this will go on for. When you've got this many teachers unhappy, what is the fix?
So what we're saying is next year there's some things that schools can do to get ready, which will take some of the pressure off principals and teachers, and there's also some things that we all need to do to support them. So in terms of getting ready for something we call hybrid learning, so expect next year you're going to have kids in the classroom, which is going to be great, but you're still going to have some students learning at home at the same time, learning online. That's called hybrid. And getting ready for that and supporting teachers and principals with strategies to do that is going to be really important. And the other thing is countries abroad where COVID's already in the community are seeing really high level of absences because teachers get exposed to a lot of COVID. So we need to prepare, schools need to prepare, and we can help them prepare to have contingency plans. For example, maybe pooling teachers across schools so that no school is struggling in isolation.
Now, Michi, thank you very much for your time this morning. That is Ruth Shinoda of the ERO.
Now, a code of conduct complaint has been laid against the Thames District Council's mayor for her controversial COVID vaccination views. Sandra Gowdy has encouraged people to contact anti-vax groups and has questioned the government's COVID response, despite being part of a unanimous council vote supporting the vaccination rollout. The council has not investigated the complaint against her, saying it's unnecessary. It is meeting today. Sam Olley reports.
Sandra Gowdy was interviewed by the anti-vax group Reignite Democracy Australia last month, filling them in on the New Zealand situation as she sees it.
There are meetings all over the place with like-minded people. There are marches. There are thousands going out to these marches. They're hardly covered by the media. Everybody's wondering what's happened to our media. It's really sad. Never thought we'd get to that in our lifetime. And here we are. And we all still remember strongly World War I and II.
She then encourages viewers to contact anti-vax groups, listing a number of them. The 12-minute video has had more than 11,000 views on YouTube.
It's just ridiculous. I think it's actually time to drop the mandates, drop the borders, open it up and just deal with it.
Ms. Gowdy has refused to get the Pfizer vaccine. She wants Novavax instead, even though it's not yet approved for use in New Zealand. Just days after she and her council passed a motion to support the vaccine rollout, Councillor Gary Gottlieb laid a complaint alleging the mayor spoke at an anti-vax meeting in Coromandel. The council says the mayor's actions have not been investigated because the matter has been resolved informally. Mr. Gottlieb disagrees.
They just parked it and hoped it would go away. But to me, it's not been resolved at all. And she continues on, flouting, absolutely flouting, laughing at us.
The mayor's interview with the Australian anti-vax group was published online on November 11 after Mr. Gottlieb's complaint. He was unaware of it until it was forwarded by RNZ, and he says it's disgraceful.
Just awful what she says, and she's completely putting the council and councillors in a terrible situation where she's ignoring a resolution of council.
Sandra Gowdy wouldn't comment to RNZ about her vaccine status, the community meeting, the video, or the code of conduct complaint.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.